ABA, FBA, BIP, IEP, totally sounds like an alphabet soup. Today we are deciphering those terms. We're talking about verbal behaviors, ABA, and speech language, and how they all relate, and how we can support our kiddos and parents, how you can support your kiddo. Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. If you are a new parent to special education or a seasoned parent sitting at the IEP table, today is a conversation you certainly want to listen in on and figure out how we can better support our children who are experiencing behavior and communication challenges. I'm talking with Rose Griffin, and we're getting some insights on behaviors, communication, and the need for a structured environment that will support behavior and improve communication. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am a mom and special educator. I have sat on both sides of the IEP table as a parent and a professional. Over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick-butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love, unsocial at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a like and a follow. If this conversation is helpful to you and you know of a parent or professional that could benefit, please share it with them. Let's get ready to strategize special education style. Welcome. Hello, and thank you for joining us. I am excited to talk about behavior and communication in ABA. And today I'm going to let our guest introduce herself and give us a little bit about your story and how you got into strategizing for students and families.
Yeah. So my name is Rose Griffin. I'm a speech language pathologist and a board certified behavior analyst. There are less than 500 people who are duly certified. So I love being able to help my students in such a very specific way. And I'm the founder of ABA Speech, which is a private practice. And we also have digital and physical therapy products. And probably what I'm most proud of is our podcast, Autism Outreach, which is actually nearing its 100th episode, which is very, very exciting. Yes. And we offer courses for parents and professionals. And what we really specialize in is helping younger autistic learners start communicating and how to help parents and professionals navigate where to get started with communication, because it can be really, really tricky. And sometimes the things that we learn in graduate school are not immediately applicable for autistic learners or students who have more complex needs. And so we really try to help parents navigate that time so that every single student has a way to communicate with the world. That's what I'm most passionate about.
It's incredibly beautiful. Incredibly beautiful. I had read somewhere you had mentioned a story about shadowing a fellow Ohio SLP. Can you share that story with us?
Yes, actually. So my mom gave me a career test my senior year of high school because I did not know exactly what I wanted to do. And it said speech therapist. That was one of the options. And I thought to myself, never heard of that, but I knew we had a family friend who was a speech therapist, and I shadowed her and her boss that day. And we did all kinds of fun things. We went to a home health client who was an older individual who I think had a stroke and they were getting speech therapy. And then we went to a school and worked with younger students, and we went to a nursing home. And I thought to myself, wow, it's amazing that you are around people all day, which actually I love. I love being around people. I love helping others. And I always really had an interest in science, but math was never my strong suit. And so this was absolutely perfect for me. And I declared my major right after that and never looked back. And it's been over 20 years now, and I'm super pleased to be in this field. And I love just being able to help people every day. My husband is in sales, which is helping in its own way in medical device sales, but he never gets that rewarding feeling that he's really helping others in such a very direct way. And so I really love what I do. So if you're thinking about it, you know, it's a great profession.
Well, good job, Mama, for giving you an assessment. I like that. Narrow it down. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, Rose, honestly, that you are such a niche in terms of SLP and ABA. One of 500 is, I mean, that's impressive.
Thank you. Yes. You know, what happened was my second year of being a speech therapist, my school job, my first year, they had a financial crisis in the district. So my position got riffed, is what they call it here in Ohio, got eliminated for the year. And so I took a position at the Cleveland Clinic, and now it's called the Learner School, but it was called the Cleveland Clinic Center for Autism. And so that's where I really learned about the science of applied behavior analysis and was able to see just such amazing transformations in students. Students who, I'll never forget, we had one student who was 18. He had been in public school services for 18 years, and he still had no way to communicate besides using very unsafe problem behavior that was a barrier to him accessing school, the community, life, really. And I was able to see that student and help that student start using an AAC device for the first time in 18 years. And that really struck a fire in me. On one side, it made me feel super, super sad and depressed that this student was going through life not being able to communicate. But on the other hand, it made me, I remember sitting in the office with my friend saying, I want to go places and I want to talk to people about the science of ABA, because it literally changes people's lives. And so that passion still is in me. And I really love to help people understand how we can use speech therapy and ABA together to help students find their path towards communication.
Let's jump into that. So can you briefly explain the basics of verbal behavior and what that means and how we can access or pick up on that and support students?
Absolutely. So verbal behavior can mean a lot of things. If you're in ABA, that might be just one approach of how you're understanding and teaching language. And so that might be something like using manding or tacting or some of these words that are jargony that you may hear from the ABA field. But for me, verbal speech and communication on a more basic level, maybe, you know, receptive language. Does a student understand language? What is their expressive language like? Are they using sign language or pictures or an AAC device or verbal or all together? And then social language, how is our student working alongside others, which I know gets a lot of flack now online. There's a lot of things that are so very negative on Instagram and social media, but my last 10 years, I worked in a middle school, high school, and I really loved that age group. And I would tell the kids, just think of me as your social coach, because whether you want to admit it or not, when you get to be an adult and you have a job, that social skill piece is very important. And that really can make or break people's ability to earn a living. And so I do think supported social skills is important for certain learners.
Can we break down ABA a little further? Like, what are, I guess even, I think you briefly mentioned just what ABA stands for our listeners that may not know. And then, you know, what are the goals of ABA?
Absolutely. So ABA is really the science of studying human behavior and applying research-based strategies and techniques to help people either increase or decrease. We call it socially significant behavior, but that just means what is meaningful for you. So that's going to be different for every single client. And I think that's what's so great about ABA is that it is very systematic. And I like being able to work with, even though I'm a BCBA, you know, a lot of times I'm really focusing just on communication. That is my niche area. And so how can I now, because ABA 10 years ago when I was getting my BCBA, it wasn't covered by insurance. Nobody knew what it was. No one was talking about it. Now everybody has a very heated opinion, whether they're passionate about it or they don't like it. And it's covered by insurance now. So there are a lot of ABA providers. And so really what I try to do is work alongside BCBAs. And that's a really a big bulk of my business is training BCBAs, working with ABA providers on how do we inform our intervention practices so that they are child-led, so that our students love, enjoy coming to therapy, and how can we help every single student have a way to communicate? Because speech therapists, I think that's really what we're great at is more natural environment, and everything can be a therapy material, and everything can be a teachable moment. And ABA is really good at using data to make informed decisions, to show progress. And so when we work together, which really is hard and doesn't always happen, we can do such great things for kids.
How long does ABA benefit a student?
Oh, well, I think ABA can benefit me and you today. every day. The science is not just for autistic learners. It is everywhere. Actually, when I read the book Atomic Habits, did you read that book by James Clear?
Yes. And I actually had the honor of listening to him speak this year at a conference. It was pretty impressive.
I want to hear about that. Yes. He's actually from Columbus, where is really close to me here in Cleveland. But when I read that book, I thought to myself, this sounds like ABA. It's very systematic. So Wendy, if I'm going to start working out and it's January 1st and it's really hard for me to work out, I know that I need to do things to set up the environment so I'm successful. I need to pick a gym that's close. It needs to be affordable. I need to have my gym clothes ready. I'm setting up the environment for success. So ABA is something that infiltrates us every single day, whether we're cognizant of that and thinking about it or not. But when I read Atomic Habits, I thought to myself, and I've always been a goal setter. This is just really how my brain works. I've always been taking data on all types of random things in my life. And I've always been a goal setter. So when I read Atomic Habits, I thought to myself, I need to meet James Clear. I have a couple of friends that have had him on the podcast because I feel like I want to say, do you know what an ABA is, James? Because this whole book is really the science of ABA. It's setting up yourself for success in these very small incremental changes, right, over time that can be so huge. And that's really what's so absolutely transformative about applied behavior analysis. When I talked about the student that was 18 and nobody was able to reach him, what happens is there are a lot of autistic learners and students with other disabilities who are hard to reach. We have to think outside of the box. Sometimes what happens here in Ohio, it's a small district. They've never had a kid like that before. They don't know what to do with that kid. That kid wafts in the schools until he gets aggressive and hurts someone, and then they get put into a specialized program. Now, that's a generalization, but that's oftentimes what happens. Now that ABA is more prevalent, I do think that a lot more schools and more consultants are doing it, and so it can help students. But not everybody may need ABA, but for the students who really need that structured approach, it really ethically is best if we are open to recommending that for students.
Can you discuss the relationship between communication barriers and autism?
Absolutely. And everybody with autism is going to be completely different. I've had a lot of amazing professionals and just individuals with autism on my podcast, and everybody's supports are different, and they've been open about sharing what those supports are. And so it's just a continuum. You know, you may have autistic learners who will never have verbal speech, and that won't be their form of communication. Or you may have autistic learners who, like Dr. Kerry Magro, do you know Dr. Kerry Magro? Have you? No. Mm-hmm. Okay. You have to look him up. He's great. He's autistic, an autistic adult, and he has his PhD now, and he's a public speaker, and that's how he makes his living. And he's a consultant for all these TV shows, and he does all these cool things. And he has a lot of sensory needs that he's shared. I've worked with him on numerous projects, but people look at him, they look at him talking, and they say something that's really, you're not supposed to say this. They say, it doesn't look like you have autism, because, you know, people don't understand that that can be damaging. And what does that even mean? It's loaded, right? But he has a lot of things that he's working through that we can't see, but he shares them with us. So he wants to make other people feel comfortable on their sensory journey. So it's really just a continuum. When I was working with older students who were in gifted classes and maybe they just had a little social component, I would just tell them, think of me as your social coach. I'm here to help you navigate social skills, because once you hit sixth, seventh grade, it's very complicated. And the thing is, even at my age of 43, I'm 43, it's still complicated. Social skills are very complicated. So having a social coach, because I just had a woman on who got diagnosed officially in her 30s or late 20s. And she said, I can talk to everybody. I can make friends. That was never an issue for me, but I understand that my brain is different. I'm autistic, and the way that my brain processes information is very different than everybody else. And I thought that was great, because obviously I'm an ally for autistic individuals, but I'm not autistic, and I don't have an autistic child. So being able to talk with people like that is really powerful for me in my practice.
And it's also powerful for folks that are, whether it's a family or an individual, to then hear other people speak and to be able to feel not alone or isolated, that they're like, oh, wait, hold on, we could do this and that. And I think that is empowering all on its own.
Good. I hope so, because I always try to have autistic people on the podcast and families who have an autistic person in the family, because I think that the more that I spend time online and have an online business, I think parents really want hope. They want a sense of community. They want to feel like they're not alone, and they want somebody to talk to about things, somebody who's positive and not negative. And I think parents just, when they ask questions online, they don't understand that people have very polarized opinions about things, and it's not always the best place to get feedback.
Correct. So let's dive a little deeper into communication and behavior and how those two work together. So is behavior a type of communication?
A lot of people would have an opinion about that. I'm more middle of the road. And I just always say, I have this clip art that I use for a lot of my trainings that I do that is a person with a detective hat on. Because if a person is having a behavior that is unsafe or is a barrier to them learning, I always think, why is that person engaging in that behavior? And if they could tell me what they wanted to tell me, what would they say? And that's not just for students who are not yet speaking. I had a student, I worked at a non-public program. I always divided my time between public and non-public. And I had a student who was fully conversational. She could be on this podcast too. She could talk with us and tell us all these fun things. But when she was feeling very heightened emotionally, she would not talk. And she didn't have selective mutism. It wasn't that diagnosis. And so I had a phrase chart for her that she helped me develop. It was very cool. She was older, so we could chit chat. And when she was not feeling like she wanted to use verbal speech, she would use this phrase chart and she would point to phrases on there. And I remember this. I would spend a lot of time thinking about this student. How can I help this student? Because she really had a lot of behavior that was a barrier in mental health issues and also autism. And so it was a lot of things that she was dealing with. So I really think we just have to be detectives. It's hard to not be really reactive, especially if it's your own child, or to take it personally if it's a student that you have. But if I feel like I'm getting unpaired with a student, or I don't have a good rapport, or if I'm seeing a student for speech therapy and maybe I was bringing them to my office, but maybe they had a behavioral moment and it feels unsafe, how can we modify that environment so I'm safe, the student's safe, we know what the behavior plan is, we have friends that can help us implement it and paraprofessionals and things like that. So I always try to set up the environment for success. And if my student is having behavior that is unsafe or that is a barrier to their learning or to them in the speech therapy session, I always obviously use my BCBA brain. I've got to have it a level up there, but you know, in the schools, I'm always working with an outside consultant. That was the district I worked in. It was extremely affluent. And even though I'm a BCBA, I wasn't paid to do that. So I worked with my outside consultant who was a friend because I know all the BCBAs in my area. So it was nice. So I think you just have to really have your detective hat on and think about why is this taking place and what can we modify?
How does ABA and SLP, how does that make its way into the IEP? And boy, that was a lot of letters in one sentence. So ABA, speech language, and how does that work? How do ABA speech language, how do they kind of come together to support that individualized education program or plan for a student?
I think that every place is going to be very, very different. I'm here in Ohio, and it is extremely common for school districts to have outside consultants, BCBAs, come into the district and to help them with students who are having behavior problems, to help them with all different types of issues. And I know that in other states, they'll say, oh, well, we can't put ABA on the IEP. I've heard people say that before. I own another business called Supervision Academy, and we provide remote supervision to people becoming BCBAs. So I get to talk to people from all over the world, really, but mostly the country. And I think it's going to really depend on where you're based and the mindset of ABA and whether it's in the schools. But here in Ohio, we would write, if there was an outside consultant that maybe came in once a month, we would write that into the IEP and it would be there. And then the BCBA would be invited to the meeting. Potentially they've done an FBA. So they're looking at why problem behavior is occurring. The student then might have a behavior intervention plan that will also be part of that IEP document. And that's what's nice, is that everybody on the team is going over those documents and has access to them, because the student is not working in a bubble. Hopefully they're not in a classroom. They should be navigating the whole larger school environment, working with many different people. And so that is really how we implemented it there, is in the IEP, based on assessment and student need.
Right, exactly. And so how would a parent that may be listening to this, how could they seek out, or any recommendations that you've heard or had or seen in terms of seeking out an ABA support and figuring out what exactly do they need? Because a lot of times parents are the ones that have to bring the data to the school and say, all right, this is what I'm seeing, so that it doesn't get muddy in terms of other team members saying, you know, we can't do this at our school. But what can we do for parents to be able to have that language to seek out somebody that can then come in and consult with the school system that may not be part of the school system to help support that child through their school day and to help with the IEP team?
I think one thing is, usually what happens in a public school is that if a student is engaging in behavior that is a barrier to them learning and making progress with IEP goals. I actually just had a client tell me this, and I was really, really surprised that this happened here where I'm from, that their son is younger. He was on a different medicine. He was having some problem behavior that was not characteristic of him. School called the parent, and the parent had to come get him based on his behavior. So I'm sure this is not a surprise to you working in the field that you work in, but parents listening, that's not appropriate. That's really never, ever appropriate. So number one, if that happens to your child, and number two, if they haven't had a FBA done, which is just a fancy term for us understanding why a student is engaging in this behavior, then that's step one. And how we do that in a public school is typically the school psychologist is where you would start. And so if you think your child is engaging in behavior, and it doesn't have to be aggressive behavior, it could be eloping, it could be leaving the classroom, it could be not being able to sit in their chair, it could be not being able to go out for whatever classes they usually go out for, I would say I'm formally requesting the school psychologist to do an FBA so that we can understand what's going on. Number two, from that, you should have a behavior plan that everybody on the team knows about, the speech therapist, the occupational therapist, the gym teacher. That really is very important that everybody at minimal has a copy of it and understands what it means. And I think that's so important. I was really surprised that the parents that I work with, I see a couple private clients here in Ohio, didn't know what an FBA was, because their child gets ABA and their child does have behavioral barriers. And so I was trying to coach them. I feel like I do a lot of advocating for my parents and parent coaching, because that's really, really important. It's your right as a parent. That's the student's right. And every student should be in school, and that behavioral piece really needs to be taken care of. And now I feel like there are so many BCBAs. The field is just growing. It's an upward trend. And you really need to just start interviewing people in your area to find somebody that you like. And obviously, if your school district is saying no, you know, get an advocate that's friendly and collaborative, but firm, and then work on getting what your child needs.
Let's take a step back. Can you break down behavior plans or behavior intervention plans?
Absolutely. So a behavior intervention plan will be done after we understand what are the certain behaviors that the student is engaging in that might be a barrier to them learning in their classroom, might be a barrier to them going out into the community. And so then what we typically look at are things that we can do, we say antecedently. So before, what can we do so this behavior doesn't take place? So maybe, like we've talked about, we need to modify the environment. It could be something as easy as visuals. Maybe the student needs a visual schedule. Not every autistic student needs that, but some students do benefit from visuals. Maybe they need some reminders about their day. Maybe if there's a fire drill, they need to be warned about that a week in advance, 5 days in advance, 4 days in advance, and we're going over the story and we have the headphones on. Every student is going to be different, but what we're trying to do is setting our student up for success so that these behaviors don't occur. And then communication is a huge part of that, functional communication training. If I can say, I need a break, I don't want to do that right now, I'd rather do something different, I'm just thinking of all the stuff I've taught my students, I need one more minute, things like that, to try to navigate their world with communication instead of unsafe problem behavior, that's really, really impactful. And then obviously for safety reasons, we do need to have a plan, because I worked at middle school, high school, and then you get adolescents involved in there and all different types of things. And it's a whole new ball game. And sometimes students are going to engage in behavior. And so we need to have a plan so that the staff is safe, so that the student is safe. And that, so if something occurs, that the parents are very in the loop on what has occurred and what the plan is should something happen in the school environment. And so in the district I worked in, every district I've worked in, I think it's just because I'm interviewing the districts when I was working in the schools, but we always had, we're crisis trained and we had teams, and it's just, it's really up to your district to have that responsibility and to have that collaborative loop with the parent as well.
So I just want to kind of clarify for folks that may not know that your FBA, your functional behavioral analysis, is going to come first so that you can look at the behavior, see what's happening, and then from there determine a behavior intervention plan, or a BIP, depending on your acronyms that you use. What does the federal law say about behaviors as it relates to special education, a free appropriate education, and an individualized education plan?
Ooh, I'm not sure. I did take the rights law course recently, actually. I think I told you that. I joined COPA and everything last year. But I'm not sure exactly. At some point, some students do engage in behavior that is unsafe for the district, is unsafe for the student. And here in Ohio, we do have not quite a few non-public programs that help educate students that cannot be safely educated in a public school. And I've spent my whole career working in non-public programs and public schools, kind of dividing my time. And it's hard because sometimes parents will think, well, you know, public school's not good. This isn't good enough. I really want my kid to be in this non-public program. But if you really tour the non-public program, all the students are usually in there because they have very unsafe problem behavior. So it's a very different dynamic. And it's hard to recreate things that you just naturally have in a public school, like getting on a bus with peers and having gym class and having adapted physical education and having music programs and opportunities for field trips. Every non-public program is going to be different, but what the non-public program is trying to do is trying to recreate the public school education so that the students can have that, but that they can have that level of intensity of therapy and usually ABA or whatever specialized service it is. But I always feel sad for students whose parents think that that's the better option, when really we just need to tighten up what is happening in the public school. But you know how that goes. It's very hard, right? There's a lot of staff training. People have to be on board. We have to have administrative support. There has to be money behind that training. And so it gets very, very complicated. But if you can find a public school that will work with you, and now there's so many ABA providers, you could probably do a little after school ABA and kind of put together a nice little program for your child. I really do think, depending on where you live, the public schools have a lot to offer.
What can the school do to provide accommodations for students that are trying to communicate through behavior?
Yeah. Well, implement the behavior plan, be trained on what to do before the behavior occurs. I think that sounds so simplistic, to make sure that everybody has a copy of the behavior plan. But what happens, and it may not happen at meetings that you're at, because I'm sure if you're attending IEP meetings, it's probably all hands on deck. Everybody's staying for the full meeting. But what happens at a very like kind of run of the mill IEP is that, you know, gen ed teachers there, special ed teacher, principal, speech therapist might come in, do their part, might have to leave because they have to start seeing students. If they miss those sessions, they have to be made up. OT might come in, do their part, have to leave, PT, et cetera, job coach. So as simple as it sounds, making sure that every single person on the team has the behavior plan. Asking your speech therapist, do you have Joe's behavior plan? Do you need me to give you a copy of it? I wouldn't try to catch somebody in a lie, because the speech therapist may not, oh, well, he's always fine when he's with me. Everybody has a different idea, but we have to have, I'm very old school. So I have this clipboard, and this is how I've operated the past 20 years. But when I had students who had a behavior plan, I just always had it readily available. So I was in the loop on what to do before a behavior and if something would happen.
And I encourage parents all the time through my IEP coaching, because I've been a special ed teacher sitting at that table. I've also, my middle son has medical needs, so I've been a parent sitting at that table. And if parents are listening now, I would say that it was super hard for me as a parent and a professional to be at that table. It still is. So it's very emotional, right? So you're, as a parent, you're coming from a place of this fear and love. And so I would encourage parents to really even invite a friend to come along to hear, because you're absolutely right in terms of IEP meetings, depending on people's schedule, and depending on the district, depending on the school, folks are coming in and out of that meeting. So to be able to ensure that everybody on that team understands that child, understands the child's needs, has access to all of that. And I know some professionals are listening and saying, of course, they have to. Yes, we know that, but we want to make sure parents know that they can be the, take the lead on this communication part, to be that accountability partner for the team, to ensure that everybody on the team understands what's taking place for your baby, for your child.
Absolutely. I think that's really important, is that we shouldn't just assume that everybody has a copy of the behavior plan. And we shouldn't just assume that everybody understands what it means. And I think that that's important to push for if your student is going to be navigating the larger school environment and everybody needs to be on board with how things should be set up or what to do if something were to happen, to really say, can the BCBA, can the school psychologist do a staff training at the start of the year, at the end of the year, if there's a change, and can we document that? I think those things are all, because especially if your student is older, middle school, high school, a lot of times teachers are getting together in grade level teams or department teams. And so it's easy to catch, it's almost easier, I always thought, at middle school, high school, to catch all the teachers together. So, but that's really important to logistically make sure. And we have a lot of PD time in our schedule where we have to do certain trainings. And there's absolutely no reason why that can't be a day to go over behavior plan.
Right. Exactly. And so should IEP goals reflect the goals of ABA?
I think so. I don't think you need to say ABA in your goal, but the way that I would write my goals, you could probably tell that I'm a speech therapist and a BCBA because they're pretty structured, but I don't think you need to say ABA. But if a child has a behavior intervention plan, they're probably going to have a goal, a behavior goal, because that's a reason that we're working on that. And absolutely, I don't think you need to put ABA into the goal, but I think having it in the services section, if you want to have a BCBA that's going to do a plan or update your child's plan or monitor or train staff, which is really important, especially now, because, you know, every district is different, but there can be a lot of turnover and things like that. We need to just make sure that everybody is on board and that we have ongoing communication. And that's really important.
Can you expand on that in terms of giving us some like techniques or strategies or structure, that what it would look like for a child possibly in their IEP and then in their school day of combining SLP and ABA?
Absolutely. So something that I think that is a really robust way to work on communication is that the speech therapist really is not the most important person on the team. I drive the ship. I do the assessment. I come up with the communication goals. That's my expertise. Do I see the student? I do. And I know that parents, and this is always hard for me because in my private practice, I have a great rapport with my parents. They like me. I come into their house. In a public school, I always, especially where I worked, it was very affluent. So people were very guarded and they really just thought, oh, this is a public school. They're going to give us the bare minimum. So they would really, I'd have a kid who was getting maybe 2 times a week for speech, 3 times a week for speech, which is a lot of speech. And these parents would want 4 times a week of speech. And what I really wanted to say to them, which you can't in a public school, but I stepped away from that after 20 years in May to work on ABA speech, is it's not about me. I'm not the most important person. I see your child once a week for 30 minutes, twice a week for 30 minutes. You know who's most important? The teacher. You know who's really most important? The paraprofessionals. That who is most important. So what I always try to do, the way to think about it, is wraparound services, generalization, is I would work on communication during speech therapy sessions, but the data binder would live in the classroom. And so then I would train the teacher and the parapro on how to run the communication programming. Now, that was something that we did in a non-public school. the registered behavioral technicians would run my communication programs under my direction on the days the students didn't have speech. And so that's definitely something I brought from my non-public side of my life to my public school that I think made my communication program really awesome that a lot of people don't do. Because it's not about when the student's with me. It's really about what are they doing all day. Communication takes place all day. It's what happens outside of the therapy room. So I always tried to, now I had been in this district 10 years. So I had built rapport with everybody and it was like a well-oiled machine. But in the beginning, I would do trainings and I would do things like that and build rapport with people so that they would run the communication programs on days that the student doesn't have speech, because that's what's most important. Where is the child every day? Do they have their device out? Are they using their device? Do the people know what's in the device? These are simple questions, but they're super important. And actually, it doesn't have a ton to do with the speech therapist. It's more about a training component.
And training the parent as well with that device. If a child has a device, training the parent. So yes. And I love that constant communication with a team, and then that ability to take what a child has learned in one-on-one therapy and be able to apply it to their everyday life, whether it's in the classroom, outside of the classroom, on the playground, wherever that may be, to improve future education, independence, and employment outcomes.
Absolutely. And I had parents, I worked with some parents who were, I don't want to say demanding because that seems negative, but were very involved with their students' communication. And they would come and observe once a month because that was a right as a parent. And I would make videos. So I had a lot of students who would get speech from me, who had an outside therapist, who had an outside BCBA. And so maybe twice a month, I would make a video from my therapy room using my school district iPad, which was great that I had that, about something that we were working on. This is how we answer, what is your name? This is how we find this vocabulary word on a device. And then I would share it as a Google Drive link with the team. And I think that was really powerful too, to make sure that everybody's on the same page, that everybody's working on stuff in a similar way, so the student's not confused. And so there's all different types of things that parents can do. And I think what's most important is just to understand, what exactly does my student's day look like? And while those parent observations were stressful, I think, for everybody involved, I think it was good for the parent to see, this is what speech looks like. This is what your student looks like in the classroom when it's led by the teacher. This is how your student looks in this class. And that really is your right as a parent to be able to observe like that and to see how your child is doing. And I think that's important.
When can speech therapy begin for children? And then when should parents start to seek help?
Good question. Anytime you think, by one, kids are saying their first words. So if your child is silent and they're not babbling and saying little things, and if they don't have a word by one, you really need to say something and you really need to get them evaluated. If you have a family history of autism or anything like that, I know that they can do evaluations very young. I'm helping a couple, I'm licensed in Washington and Oregon. And so I work with some ABA providers, and we have some kids who are two, and it's just, they're babies. It's so cute because I have three kids of my own who are older now. And I'm like, oh my goodness, two, how fun is that? But immediately, if your gut instinct is that you are nervous about your child's development, then you really should seek out an evaluation. And the thing about private speech therapy is you can get an evaluation and you can see how your child is doing. If it's covered by your insurance, that's great because that'll be better. But you can always find a speech therapist who is private pay who will help you. And there's obviously birth to three services. And then once your child is three, you can get them evaluated at a public school. But early intervention is so very important, not only for your child to help them on their road to communication, but for you as the parent, so that you're not anxiety ridden. And I just know so many parents who are just sick because they're nervous about their child's development. Does my child have a speech delay? Does my child have early signs of autism? Is my child just fine? I'm listening to my aunt who said, oh, well, so-and-so didn't start talking till they were four. That's not true. Don't listen to that person. Do not listen to that person. So we try to provide a lot of programming for people at that age. And I don't know when this is going to air, but we're going to start doing once a month free parent trainings all about communication, communication milestones, what you can do every day as a parent in as little as 15 minutes to help your child start communicating.
That is fantastic. And you can share that with me. I'll put it in the show notes so people know when those trainings are and how to access that. So do parents play a role in the goals of ABA or speech language at home?
At home. Like goals for IEPs? Or goals that they're working on?
Just in general, maybe they're seeing a private ABA or private SLP or somebody that's like you that has all the trainings and they're working with somebody at home. Where does that parent come in to play?
What I think is great about ABA is that most oftentimes it is a requirement that you have parent training as part of your ABA, which is nice because they can go over some general concepts with you. They can go over how your child is doing. And I work with a lot of parents who are extremely savvy, who understand what some of the assessments are that we use, who understand what the word tact means and all these obscure ABA terms because they're fully immersed. So I do think that part is really nice. I do think if you have somebody who is outside of your ABA provider to talk with, whether it's an advocate or somebody like me who's creating content online, it's just nice to have somebody outside of your IEP team to run some items by and to get their opinion on things. But definitely, parent training is a big component of ABA services. And so that means that you'll be talking with your provider, and it should be some general implementation of ABA plus how your child is doing.
Can you discuss the Action Builder cards and their functions for student or their function for students with any types of communication barriers?
I'd love to. Yes, that's how I started my whole business. So I sell the Action Builder cards. It's a set of 100 flashcards, and there are 13 actions that are represented, and there's many different pictures. And so in the field of ABA, we call it multiple exemplar training. So if I'm going to show you a picture of eating and you're going to label eating, I'm not going to just show you one picture. I'm going to show you many pictures, like eating ice cream, eating pizza, eating apple. And then that way we can help our children generalize language skills, which is so hard for autistic learners. And so I created those 5 years ago and send them out every day to people all over the world, which is really such a joy. So if your child has an expressive language delay, it's a great tool to have at home.
Are there other tools for parents or teachers?
Absolutely. I actually have another product called Double Up, and that is for middle school, high school students. So working on leisure vocabulary and hygiene vocabulary, which is so important for our older learners. And so it's a game. You can match picture to picture. You can match picture to associated pictures, so the noun to the action. And people really love that because when I first got into the middle school, I actually filled an entire trash can in the hallway because somebody had been there for 30 years in the position who retired. And then I took the position and there was some old materials. And so I created that, and it's very hip and it's real life pictures, which is so very important for our older students, very respectful. So I think that's important. And yeah, I think those are good go-tos.
Do you have extra tips or suggestions for parents that may have concerns about their child's communication or verbal behavior?
I would just say, make sure that you get an evaluation if you're worried about your child. And then if your child is in services, make sure that you are talking with your provider and you understand how you can carry over that to the home environment. And maybe find somebody outside of your IEP team, like an advocate or somebody like ABA Speech, where we do parent training and parent consults, because sometimes it's just nice to have somebody to run things by. And I do that for my private clients all the time. They're getting speech therapy in the home, they're getting ABA, and then I come and they can ask me questions. Well, what does that mean? Will this happen? What should I do? They want to dismiss him from speech, you know, all these little things. And I can kind of weigh in and be a sounding board. It's really important that you're not going it alone. So I would make sure that you find a community or you find somebody that you can use as a sounding board. Don't ask general questions on Facebook groups or Instagram, because you can get some really, really nasty remarks that you as a parent are already navigating having a child with a disability potentially, which I'm sure there's an emotional component to that. And then somebody says something mean to you, and it's just horrific how people are treated on the internet. But maybe that's just me because I'm on there all the time. But you just have to be careful where you're asking questions.
Find the tribe. That's right. So can behaviors occur later in life with no previous sign of behavior barriers? Like, have you seen where you have a child that starts to develop behaviors as they get older and demands start to increase?
I've seen students, it really has to do with adolescence, I think, and hormones and puberty. I definitely think children in middle school and high school are going through that. And if you're autistic and you're not speaking, that is going to be a harder journey to navigate, it seems. And it's harder to find resources on how to help your child through that different type of time. So I've absolutely seen students, their behavior change in middle school and high school. Not to say that it's always going to be like that, but if you think back even to just typical development, how kids act when they're in middle school and high school, it's a growing time and you're testing boundaries. And I absolutely have seen students start to engage in different types of behaviors. And I do think it's secondary to that.
What happens if these verbal behaviors are left untreated or unsupported?
Well, I mean, then you could be like the student that I talked about at the beginning of the show who was 18 and had no way to communicate. And he really needed more specialized services. And you really have to make sure there's something called the Communication Bill of Rights, and you can Google it. And it's just making sure that everybody has their voice. So if your child uses an AAC device, we need to make sure that it's always charged and it's ready to go and that they're bringing it places in the community. I always get so excited when I see somebody who has an AAC device in the community. Yes, look it. That's great. Their speech therapist would be so proud. But if you're not, and I think this is a thing too, no matter how old your child is, if they're not able to spontaneously communicate on their own, something needs to change. The intervention needs to change. We need to do another assessment. We need to goal set, and we need to get some experts in. And I don't think that's bad. When I was working in my old district, we had a student with selective mutism, and we worked with a place called the Smart Center. It was great. I loved it. It was a lot ABA based, I thought, but it was cool. I really learned as a professional, and I love being able to learn how to help support that student because that was something that was new to me. I think as public school employees, we shouldn't feel guarded or defeated if we have to work with a consultant. I love that consultant because sometimes I could say, I think we should work on labeling Apple. And then the consultant says, well, you know what? I think we should really work on labeling Apple. And the parent goes, yep, that's right. That consultant, even though we may say the same thing, that consultant is needed to have that communication loop. And I learned that 20 years ago. So I'm fine with that. But some people feel really defensive, but we shouldn't feel that way. We should be able to learn and say that this is really going to expand our competence when we're working with students where we have to think outside of the box. They need something different.
And as an educator, you're getting this specialized input, the specialized training that you can then help support other students.
Yes.
Then you're aware of what options can be and how you can work together as a team for sure.
Absolutely. You're able to help so many more people. And that's what I say in my trainings with parents and professionals is I'm not just helping you today with the one child or the one student that you logged in for. I'm helping you for all the students that are going to present like this that you'll have over the course of your career. And now autism is 1 in 44. When I started in the field, it was 1 in 242. And we would say in 4-to-1 boys, I don't even say that kind of stuff anymore. Because we know autism in girls isn't diagnosed as much and things, but it's really changing. So you're going to know somebody with autism, and these skills are going to help you navigate those situations.
Well, even back to kind of when we started our conversation in terms of setting up an environment for success, I think benefits all students.
Absolutely.
From that special education lens, if we can set up our expectations, set up the environment, set up the needs for the learner, ahead of time and do that heavy load prior to the school year starting really benefits all students.
It does. These things are good practice, good universal things that all students will benefit from. Absolutely.
As we kind of wind down, Rose, what is something that I didn't know enough to ask I should have asked?
As a parent?
As a parent, as a professional, what did we not cover that we should have?
Oh, today? Oh gosh, that's a tough question. Well, I mean, something that you might want to ask that you may not know about is, if you are a parent and you do think that your child is benefiting from applied behavior analysis and you're in a public school, you might want to talk to your speech therapist about their thoughts on applied behavior analysis, because some speech therapists are anti-ABA and some speech therapists don't know a lot about ABA, but would learn. And so I think it's good to understand where people are coming from, because in a public school, we really have to take the parents. Your opinion matters. You're a big part of the team. And so I think that's important, because now everybody has an opinion. And so you might be working with a speech therapist and you may not be able to get much traction when you're talking about ABA or when you're bringing your BCBA into the IEP meeting. And you might be thinking, why is this taking place? And you may talk to the speech therapist and they may not like ABA. And so that might be working against you. So that's a whole other conversation, but something to think about.
What are some resources or tools that you've been using lately that have helped make lives easier for the clients that you support?
Absolutely. I really love, this may sound silly, but books and actually using my own voice. I have seen that with younger professionals, instead of reading a child a book with their own voice, they may want to look it up on YouTube. And I always train people and say, we don't want to do that. Because when we're working on that shared activity, it's all about us and the child. And listening as a parent too, it's about us and the child. If they don't sit and listen the whole time, that's completely fine. If we don't have to say the story word for word for word, we can paraphrase for our child's attention span. But I think just getting back to the basics and using books and our own voice is something that is really powerful. And I see people not doing enough.
If we had a billboard for parents with one tip, what would it be and why?
I would probably have on there, don't ask too many questions. What parents tend to do with their own children is ask a bunch of questions. So they may say, what is it? What do you do with it? What color is it? Where do you find it? And maybe this kid's using one word to communicate. We don't want to do that. Let's say that I have this little bird and I might say, oh, it's a bird. Mommy has a bird. The birdie flies up, up, up. So instead of asking questions, we use simple language. We're modeling simple language. So I would really encourage parents. And I had a parent, I wrote that on a home note. Don't ask too many questions. And they put it up in their living room. And it really changed their behavior. They have an autistic child. It really changed their behavior. And so now they're just using more simple language to narrate their day, talk about things. And that's been huge.
How can people find you?
Yeah, come and visit me. ABASpeech.org is my website. And ABASpeech by Rose is my Instagram, where I add daily content all about helping autistic learners on their road to communication.
If I'm a parent and I'm looking for your services, how do you prefer to be contacted?
Yeah, through the website is great. ABASpeech.org. I have a whole section that's called Work With Me. And so I do parent consults. We have courses that are geared towards parents. One in particular is called Start Communicating Today. And that is all about helping students start communicating. How do we get started in communication at home as a parent? And I've had a lot of parents take that course, and it's been really, really beneficial for their children in helping them start talking.
Incredible, incredible nuggets. I love it. Thank you for your time. You have just enlightened us and given us a direction, and now people know where to find you if they have more questions to get answered. So I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you again for listening to these incredible positive insights and nuggets to help broaden our understanding of ABA, SLP, and supporting students with behavior and communication. My three special ed strategy takeaways from this podcast include: parents can formally request for an FBA to understand why a child is engaging in certain behaviors. And what can we do to modify the environment to support learning and communication? And as a parent, seek support, find your community, and trust your gut. Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious time listening. If you love what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials. Looking for free tips? Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com and you can download free tips to prepare for an IEP meeting, plus bonus questions to ask. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching and educational therapy. BrainCamp is our executive function support model. If you're a parent, we've got you covered through our IEP coaching.